Uganda is a young country. Many, if not most, of its citizens have known no other leader than Yoweri Museveni, who has held Uganda's presidency since he first seized it in 1986. But any Ugandans wanting to see a change at the top are going to have to wait a while longer. Earlier this week, Museveni was declared the winner of Uganda's latest presidential election, convincingly defeating his main rival, Bobi Wine, a pop star who has leveraged his popularity among Uganda's youth into a political movement. The election campaign was violent. Dozens of people were killed. The election itself is of perhaps debatable legitimacy. There were no international observers, either or both, because Ugandan authorities refused to accredit them or because their recommendations had been ignored on previous occasions. The internet was shut off. The authoritarian overreach did not cease even after President Museveni's victory was officially confirmed. Bobi Wine was placed under house arrest, confined to his Kampala home by the army Museveni commands. If Uganda has to resign itself to another 5 years of Yoweri Museveni, what is the best it can hope for? Or might Bobi Wine and the generation he represents actually have been strengthened by this loss? This is the Foreign Desk.
Some of the killings that Amin is blamed for, I think, have to be put in perspective, in that even since he left, governments that came after him that have had to battle insurgencies have behaved pretty much the same way. So in my opinion, it seems as if a government that is fighting for its survival will definitely lose all sense of proportion and lash out.
So right now, we have his lawyers in court filing a case to, you know, expedite his immediate release. But in terms of what next, I don't think we've seen the last of Bobi Wine. Bobi Wine has come with, you know, a drive to just ignite change.
The president and his colleagues really think that they are in the throes of some other occasion that requires the use of military means to contain what they see as this popular leader that is intent to create some kind of Arab Spring uprising in Uganda.
Hello and welcome to the Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. Let's start with a look at how Uganda got here. Joining me from Kampala with a brisk recap of Uganda's modern history is Frederick Goluba Mutebi, Research Associate at the Overseas Development Institute. Frederick, let's start in 1962 when Uganda becomes independent. At that time, what was the original idea of what an independent Uganda would look like? What was supposed to be the constitutional framework at the outset?
Well, I'm sure you've heard that in Africa, when we got independence, we were all very optimistic about self-rule and what that would bring. And in Uganda specifically, we had this constitutional arrangement whereby some regions of the country enjoyed a federal relationship with the central government and others enjoyed a unitary relationship. So it was a hybrid state from 1962. With regions such as Uganda and other monarchical regions enjoying quite a great deal of autonomy.
So we should probably at this point introduce the figure of Milton Obote, who kind of puts himself in charge of everything in 1966. Who was he and how did he get there?
Well, Obote became prime minister and eventually president. I think from the beginning it was purely by accident because he had left Uganda, gone to Kenya and become a member of the trade union movement there. He came back to Uganda, got himself elected head of this political party, which was called the Uganda National Congress, which later became the Uganda People's Congress. And he formed an alliance with the Uganda establishment. And in that way, he won the elections that led to independence in 1962, whereby he became prime minister, that was the deal, and then the king of Buganda became the president. But then, for so many reasons, they couldn't work together because they had all these diametrically opposed views about where the country should be headed and how it should be governed. And so it was on the basis of those misunderstandings that we came to a direct confrontation between the Kabaka the king and Dr. Obote, which led to the invasion of the Kabaka's palace and the overthrow of the monarchy in Buganda and the overthrow of all the other monarchies and the declaration of Uganda as a republic.
Now, in the time that Obote got to be president before he was overthrown himself, and we will get there shortly, what kind of president was he?
Obote, he had these pretensions to being a socialist, and he wanted to turn Uganda into a socialist state. I think in many ways he was trying to ape Julius Nyerere in Tanzania and Nkrumah in Ghana and Kenneth Kaunda in Zambia. Now, by the time he overthrows the Buganda monarchy, he goes on to impose himself even on his own political party, Uganda People's Congress. He arrests everybody who was opposed to him. The sheer action of invading the king's palace using the army introduces the military to politics, and the military becomes a major player in politics. And this is how Idi Amin, I think, got the idea that if he could support President Obote to take power, he could take power for himself. And he did in 1971.
Well, at that point, we do need to consider the extraordinary character of Idi Amin, who, as you were just explaining, ends up governing Uganda throughout the 1970s. Was he regarded, certainly in Uganda at the time, a figure of fear? To what extent do Ugandans see it now that he was somebody who ruled through terror?
Yes, he did rule by fear. I think in the later years of his government, he was battling this insurgency waged by, among others, the current president, Yoweri Museveni, who had an insurgent group at the time. And there were other Ugandan exiles who had formed groups that were making an effort to topple Idi Amin by force of arms. So some of the killings that Amin is blamed for, I think, have to be put in perspective, in that even since he left, governments that came after him that have had to battle insurgencies have behaved pretty much the same way. So in my opinion, it seems as if a government under siege, a government that is fighting for its survival, will definitely lose all sense of proportion and lash out. And we have seen that even under the current government. We who were here when President Museveni became president, we never expected his soldiers to go around shooting people in the street in cold blood. But again, one could say he now fears for his own survival, that of his regime, and he's behaving pretty much like Obote and Idi Amin before him.
Well, let's look at the end of Amin's rule in 1979. Tanzania intervenes to unload him, and shortly afterwards you see Milton Obote making a comeback. Why did Tanzania finally act against Amin, and how was Obote able to maneuver himself back into the job?
First of all, we need to understand that after Idi Amin toppled Obote, Obote himself and a lot of his supporters and other dissidents left Uganda and exiled themselves in Tanzania. So Tanzania was a hive of anti-Amin political and military activity. There were several invasions of Uganda from Tanzania in the early 70s by groups that were seeking to topple Idi Amin by force of arms. So from the word go, from the time Idi Amin toppled Obote, relations between Uganda and Tanzania were pretty tense. Now it happens that Idi Amin, by some kind of foolish act, he goes on to invade Tanzania. I think this is in 1978, and to annex part of Tanzanian territory on the grounds that this was Ugandan territory. And in that way, he offered Nyerere an opportunity to use Ugandan exiles in Tanzania to topple him. And so Nyerere convened them and organized them and armed them and supported them to come and topple Idi Amin. He even sent in his own army to provide them military backup. That's how Idi Amin was toppled.
Well, let's have a look at the current incumbent then, Yoweri Museveni, who we'll be discussing at greater length later in the show, because he undergoes an extraordinary trajectory in the 1980s. There's a point in the early 1980s in which he's in the bush with maybe a few dozen other men, one of whom, in a curious quirk of history, is Paul Kagame, who goes on to become president of Rwanda, as indeed he still is. How does Museveni get from there to becoming president of Uganda?
Museveni started waging wars of insurgency against sitting governments almost as soon as Idi Amin toppled Obote. And he did this throughout the 70s, sending his own agents into Uganda, some of whom were captured and executed by firing squad. You may recall Idi Amin executing some people in public by firing squad. Some of these were Museveni's associates who were waging an insurgency against the Amin government. Now, of course, when Nyerere decides to organize Ugandan exiles, again, President Museveni, by then 20-something-year-old, was again part of that setup. He had his own armed group called FRONASA, Front for National Salvation, which fought alongside Tanzanian forces and other exiles to topple Idi Amin. Museveni serves in the post-Idi Amin government, occupying various positions. And when Obote returns in 1980, in preparation for elections that would usher in an elected post-Idi Amin government, Museveni decided he would form a political party with his associates, which they did. And then he became the head of that party. It was a very small party made up of young people like himself in their 20s. Ugandans didn't take them that seriously at the time. And that's why they didn't make much headway. They won only one seat in parliament. Museveni tried to run for parliament. He failed. He lost his deposit. But he and his group then said the elections had been rigged and therefore they would not legitimize the government of Obote, Obote II, as we call it here. So they went to the bush to wage an insurgency to top Obote by force of arms, which they did within a period of 5 years. And that's how Museveni becomes president of Uganda.
Frederick Galuba Mutebi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined now by Angelo Izama and Ingrid Nantegi. Ingrid Nantegi is a TV host and reporter at Metropole TV, and Angelo Izama is a writer and analyst. Angelo, I'll start with you. Let's talk first about the election before we move on to other things. Obviously, Yoweri Museveni, the re-elected president, is claiming that the whole thing was free, fair, and above board, etc. And Bobi Wine, his currently semi-imprisoned opponent, claims very much the opposite. Do we have a clear idea yet, really, of how free or fair this election was?
Not really. Most of the other Ugandan elections have gone into a period of dispute, which has played out in court. But what has been tricky about previous challenges to presidential elections actually is the transmission of results from polling stations to the tallying center. I think what Bobi Wine's organization is saying is that in the absence of independent tallying, in the absence of a clarity of how those election results are actually compiled at the National Tally Center, and, you know, complicated as it were by a nationwide internet blackout and a series of other, you know, security-related events, you know, arrests and so on and so forth of their agents, that you cannot guarantee that this is a free and fair election. But that said, Ugandan elections tend to be basically, you know, in two parts. You have got the municipal elections, which are really elections for MP, which are the majority of elections. And I've taken in and I've written about this. These local MP elections tend to be very fiercely competed for within the National Resistance Movement Party, the President's Party. Intra-party competition is actually at its most fiercest when they hold their primaries. So when we hold parliamentary and presidential elections, the results of the MP races tend to be supported by parties across the board. And Bobi Wine's party actually, even if it was established less than a year ago, now has the most seats for an opposition party. They're not disputing those results. What they're really saying is that they cannot guarantee that the results for the presidential poll itself is fair. And there is a slight contradiction there, but it would have been settled if, of course, there was independent tallying.
Ingrid, let's talk a bit about Bobi Wine, the apparently defeated challenger for Uganda's presidency. What are his circumstances likely to look like in coming weeks and months? I mean, does President Museveni think he can keep Bobi Wine under house arrest forever?
That's a very good question. And I would like to throw my weight on what my colleague Angelo said, and when it comes to setting a precedent on what the Ugandan election looks like. But to bring it back to Bobi Wine, I mean, like you rightly said, the gentleman has been under house arrest since the election happened. even prior to the election, you know, he's really gone through a lot of, you know, restraint. There's been so much in terms of the government trying to get in the way of his campaign. So in terms of what's next for him, I mean, we're looking at a situation where the election, the vote was cast last week, the results are out, and he's still under house arrest. And the government has really, really, when it comes to Bobi Wine, pulled out all the stops when it comes to military deployment, when it comes to just restricting his movement. So right now we have his lawyers in court filing a case to, you know, expedite his immediate release. But in terms of what next, I don't think we've seen the last of Bobi Wine. Bobi Wine has come with, you know, a drive to just ignite change. We're seeing a situation where he's already appealing the result of the election. So I feel like we need to get over the hurdle of why is he still under house arrest? Why is his wife still being contained? So when finally that gets out of the way and we get proper answers to what's going on, so we'll be seeing a lot more of Bobi Wine. This is not the end. We're going to see a lot more in terms of just creating an uprising.
Angelo, how will that decision to place Bobi Wine under house arrest be playing in Uganda? Because usually, of course, in the course of a free and fair election, if you've won it, you're supposed to respond to your vanquished opponent with an amount of magnanimity. You congratulate them on their campaign, look forward to them being a worthy opponent in the years ahead, and so forth. Will locking Wine up in this manner be seen in Uganda as a sign of strength or weakness on Museveni's part?
Well, it will definitely be seen as a sign of might. I don't know, strength is not the term that I would use. But let me just say that the election was initially foreshadowed by the coronavirus lockdown. And Uganda had one of the more severe lockdowns. And in my view, anyway, the military and the security establishment basically rehearsed how to lock down the country in the face of a crisis. And this kind of played out prior to the election day. They fanned out into towns and cities. It is a stretch of the imagination to even refer to it as a civic exercise, except that people did come out and cast their ballots. And I would say that rather than being a civic exercise in regard to Bobi Wine, he actually has been, I mean, the language used and the actions that followed by the security services and the president is to treat him as a rebel, nothing short of an armed insurgent. In fact, the word insurgency was used initially when he was arrested during the campaign and there was spontaneous protests that led to the killing of nearly 60 people. So I think that while the world, and in fact some many Ugandans, look at what is going on in the eyes of the just concluded election, that the president and his colleagues really think that they are in the throes of some other occasion that requires the use of military means to contain what they see as really, and they have said it, they see this young man, the popular leader, as someone who is supported by external forces that is intent to create some kind of Arab Spring uprising in Uganda. And they have actually identified who they think is behind Bobi Wine. The president has accused, through proxies, he has accused the local American mission of not just interfering, but attempting to create instability in Uganda. They have spoken about regime change with regard to unnamed foreign actors. So let's just say that their approach to Bobi Wine, which will have an impact on his freedom in the months to come, is whether or not they still see him as a legitimate political actor who is using lawful and nonviolent means to participate in the political process, or someone who is essentially, you know, using the platform of politics to try and cause regime change with his friends from the outside.
Ingrid, it's very tempting, I think, or has been certainly for a lot of outside observers looking at Uganda in the last couple of years, to see this as essentially a generational conflict. And it's easy to see how that narrative builds. You have Yoweri Museveni, who's quite an old man, has been president forever, and his opponent, who I think is literally exactly half his age, who has a background as a hip-hop artist, representing a suppressed and frustrated youth. Is it actually that simple? Is what is going on in Uganda a conflict between generations, or are there more levels to it than that?
So in terms of a generational conflict, we're seeing more youth backing up Bobi Wine. We're seeing, you know, the people who are fighting for change more than ever, who I would say are the ones who ideally have been affected or impacted by the current rule when it comes to, you know, the employment levels, when it comes to just talk about the current state of the country, whether it's healthcare, whether it's the economy. So if it's a generational thing, most of the people in Uganda have only seen a Museveni regime. And as to whether it's worked or not, the differences in opinion are there. But yes, in a way, you know, it's a fight for someone who can resonate with the biggest population of, you know, people in Uganda and who can actually bring on board change that people can feel and real practical solutions.
Angelo, is part of that conflict reflective of the fact that Bobi Wine supporters and perhaps people of Bobi Wine's age or younger, and that is that generation who really can't recall anybody else being president but Yoweri Museveni, that they just have a different way of looking at Uganda's post-independence history than maybe people of Museveni's generation? Because what I'm wondering here is if part of Museveni's pitch was always that, okay, I may be rough and I may be authoritarian, but at least I'm not Milton Obote or Idi Amin. And maybe to younger generations, those names don't mean all that much anymore.
Well, there's a lot of interest these days in Milton Obote and Idi Amin. In fact, if you look at the results of this current election, and especially where Bobi Wine's party has won, it very much looks like, you know, the 1960s, where the center of the country, you know, voted entirely for a Muganda president, or for that matter, the local cultural leader, and the rest of the country went a different way. And right after that, as many people might not recall, there was a constitutional crisis and the military was introduced for the first time in Uganda's politics. And Amin himself these days is being looked at more favorably by young people who are questioning for the first time, you know, whether he may have been misrepresented, seeing that they have their own evidence of high-handedness in government. I think, on the other hand, that young people in Uganda and young people in Africa are much more connected today, share realities that are similar. There is a lot of joblessness, or for that matter, jobless growth, inequality. They're dealing with changing work environment, changing approaches to issues. Their major concerns would not even be present in the minds of the older generation, you know, concerns about, you know, internet and interconnectivity and things like that. And to that extent, their viewpoint is very different. And I think Yoweri Museveni, by the way, is rather disconnected from these young people. He's tried during the campaign to appear as a youngish older person who understands young people. But it was immediately clear that, you know, Bobi Wine was resonating with young people across the board in Uganda. And I think that is one of the miscalculations that his campaign did, was to dismiss Bobi Wine as, you know, a flash in the pan. And then when the campaign started going, it went underway, they realized that he actually did have deep support across Uganda from young people.
Well, Ingrid, on that thought, let's look at what Bobi Wine might do next. It does now appear fairly clear that he's not going to be president. It does also appear, however, as we've also been discussing, that his party might actually have done quite well in the parliamentary elections. Is it possible that despite this defeat, he will now be a stronger presence than he was in Ugandan politics, and perhaps especially because President Museveni has done things like place him under house arrest?
Oh, absolutely, Andrew. I would say in terms of Bobi Wine buying his credibility or just proving, you know, what his vision for the country is and what he's fighting for, I feel like he's done pretty well in the minds of most Ugandans and even, you know, people on the continent, people in the world looking in. Because, I mean, this is someone who, regardless of what has been thrown his way, I mean, he's been doubted on several occasions. People have poked holes in the way he does things. I mean, prior to the presidential election, Bobi Wine was representing his constituency, Chadondo East. So he had already put his foot in. And then here we are, we've seen him come as a very, very strong contender, which, if we're to be fair, and, you know, for lack of a better word, has kind of taken the ruling government out of their comfort zone. So yes, I feel like he's done a pretty good job in proving himself as, you know, a politician and what he stands for.
And Angelo, if we go back to President Museveni, who is clearly determined to crack on for another 5 years, I mean, it has to be said that not only are the precedents for African leaders staying in power that long not encouraging, I can't really think of a president of anywhere who's done their best work in their fifth decade in the job. Is there any reason at all to be optimistic about where Museveni might still be able to take Uganda, or is there perhaps more concern about him going full tilt Robert Mugabe?
I think it's the highway to Harare, really, because if you take the work that he said that is left undone while accepting his nomination by his party to run for this office for this time, I read it with interest, but he presented himself as an actor on the great stage of history, someone whose political activity is intended to save black people, the black race, deal with imperialism and bring an end to the suffering of African people and African unity and that sort of thing. Clearly, that scale of ambition suggests to me not that he believes this can be accomplished before, you know, his time comes to an end, but that he intends to stick around till the end. I think it resembles more Zimbabwe, because in terms of his policies, his approach to the economy, his approach to peace and security in the region, none of those things have changed. He thinks that the economy will grow by increased taxation and diversification into agribusiness, certain types of industrialization and the building of infrastructure. He's very proud of Uganda's Chinese-backed big projects like the power dams and stuff. These are brick and mortar projects, and you must understand that the vote for Bobi Wine was in a sense a vote against that vision of progress, because Bobi Wine essentially was speaking to something else about the aspirations of young people. And the president is, you know, not thinking about this sort of materialistic progress instead of the emotional progress that people see and recognize that, you know, the time for him and his 1940s generation has come to an end, and they really just want change. And even if that change is for change's sake, it is something that they're willing to accept.
Angelo Izama and Ingrid Nantege, thank you both very much for joining us. That's it for this week's episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The producers are Christy Evans and Yolene Goffan. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.